Today is Tuesday, August 25th, 2015. This is Pauline Adams, and I am interviewing former president and current professor of economics, Cecil Mackey, at Michigan State University. Your life has been and continues to be so full that it is difficult to know where to begin. So let's begin at the beginning with your childhood and early youth, where you were born, where you grew up, your early childhood, including school experiences.
All right. I was born and grew up in Montgomery, Alabama. I went to a private school for the first grade. Alabama had an unusual law. You couldn't start the first grade if you were less than 6 years old. And a lot of people did what I did. They went to a private school for the first grade when you were 5 years old. And then at six, you could enter the second grade because you had passed. It just so happened that my parents rented an apartment in the home of a teacher who taught. And so I lived upstairs and walked downstairs to the first grade. A very, very nice arrangement. The rest was pretty much routine public school. I graduated from high school in 1945. I was born in 1929. So from my birth until I was 16 and out of high school, all I knew was the Depression and the Second World War. But that got me out of high school.
No specific incidents during that time that you can recall?
Well, the world was very different then. The war was going on by the time we got into junior high. And that made a real difference for most everybody. I was, like a lot of other people who were under the age of being drafted, so I was trying to get out of high school early so I could get a year of college before I was 17. And that meant going to summer school 2 summers and taking some extra work, but I only went to high school for 2 years and graduated. And then we got off to school in the summer of 1945. VE Day was just about the last week of my high school, and VJ Day came in August. So I was there. I had never planned on anything but going into the Army. And so nobody had any plans for what you were going to do.
So tell us about your college education, things like what college you attended, what your undergraduate major was, and what attracted you to that major.
Well, I started school at Georgia Tech. I thought I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. I didn't know what aeronautical engineers did, but I'd always been fond of flying. So I went to Georgia Tech and was there for 3 semesters, a summer and then a fall and then a spring. And I decided I was not going to be an engineer. And so I transferred to the University of Alabama. And I changed my major 3 times while I was at Georgia Tech, from being an aeronautical engineer the first semester to being an industrial engineer the second semester, and to being an industrial management the 3rd time. Then I got to Alabama and wasn't sure what I wanted to be either, so I ended up changing majors a couple of times, and at the end turned out with an econ major. And I was happy with that. I had a couple of very good professors.
Do you remember what might have turned you on to economics? Was it a professor, or was it the subject matter, or?
It was 2 professors I had. Both of them had considerable global experience. One of them had been in the U.S. government and had served during the war with the government. The other had graduated from his graduate work and gone to India and had spent time there and was very fond of that. And among other things, it had some pretty dramatic experiences with the recession and then the inflation in Germany while he was on his way getting over to India. The two of them, Professors Havens and Postian, were the principal influence on my choices. I liked both of them. I liked what they taught, and they influenced my choices.
Am I right that part of your early professional life outside, once you graduated from college, was outside of academia?
Oh, I'm not sure how to define that. I finished my undergraduate degree and had just turned 20 and didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I decided to stay and maybe go back and take some industrial engineering. And so I did that for one or two quarters. I don't remember exactly how many months it was. But by the fall again, I decided that wasn't appropriate, and these two professors suggested that I consider getting a master's in economics. So I followed their advice and enrolled. The draft had a major influence on my career. In the fall of 1948, I changed my major. I was going to go to school that summer, and I didn't do that. I went to Wisconsin to work in a camp, and I would have graduated that summer, but I didn't because I went off to camp.
Was that a children's camp?
No. Well, it was, I guess, a Boy Scout type camp.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a boys' camp, and they drew their camp counselors from the fraternity that was related to the Boy Scouts. And that's how I became aware of it. I'd been north of Kentucky once, but other than that, I'd rarely been north of northern Alabama. And I went up there. And the draft was unusual because it meant I would be drafted and get called in to the Korean conflict later. But I had a cousin who was in the National Guard. He was executive officer of the National Guard unit in Tuscaloosa. And he undertook a special effort and got a significant number of the athletes who played football and basketball in the Guard. And my cousin and I were sort of the sideline beneficiaries. He said, "Why don't you two join?" I was in Wisconsin. And he said, "We'll send you the papers and you can send them back." And so I ended up going into the Guard, stayed in for about 2.5 years, but I came back and went to school while I was still in the Guard. And then the Korean War broke out, and I decided, my roommate was a pilot, and I was too. We'd both gotten our private pilot's licenses. He wanted to be in the Air Force, and I wanted to be in the Navy. So we both went down very shortly after the Korean War broke out and signed up. And I went off, took them a while to get the Navy call in order. So it took them from sometime in August or early September, somewhere along there, until January to get me into the flight program. But I got into the Navy for pre-flight. It turned out that the law as it had been written at that time allowed anybody who wanted to get out just to say, "I'd like to resign." And that was very unusual. And the Navy figured out that was not a good plan to have. And so they changed it. And it meant that those of us who had gotten in a certain period had a privilege that nobody else had. And about that time was just after we were finishing up pre-flight. There was a headline in the Sunday paper, Pensacola paper, that said there were going to be hundreds of thousands of students to be deferred. And that was a very unusual thing. They were passing the law so you couldn't get out, but we had a contract that said we could. So they allowed us to exercise that. And I had three roommates, two from Minnesota, one from was from Georgia, and all four of us resigned at the same time. And there were a lot of people who did. And one of the sayings was, if you start thinking about when you're going to get out, you'll be thinking about that instead of where you're going to land as you come around to land. So if you're going to get out, get out. So I got out and went back to school and worked on my master's degree and did all the work. But there was a woman who was head of the draft board in Tuscaloosa, and she wanted to draft me, and the law said that I had enough credit that I didn't have to be eligible, and she said, you can fight it from Fort McClellan. She was going to draft me and send me off, and she wouldn't change her mind, and the only thing I could figure out was to try to get in advanced ROTC. I had National Guard credit, I had Navy credit, now I had to go and join the Army ROTC as an advanced cadet. And I was nearly finished with my master's. So there was a man who was a major in the Army, had been called back for Korea, who had played in my father's dance band. He played a saxophone, I believe, which my father played. But he was interested, and he decided to take it to, as a matter of a challenge, see if he couldn't get me into ROTC. And he went to the Pentagon and got a decision that I could do that. I was close to finishing my master's, and they said, but you'll have to agree to serve 2 years in the military. And I said, well, if that's the only way I can keep from being drafted into the Army, I'll sign up. So I signed up, finished everything on my degree, but it couldn't be granted. I went to Illinois to start work on a doctoral program. And after the first year of that, I was able to submit the completion of that work. I got my commission not quite that easy. I had to transfer from the Army to the Air Force to get my commission and my credit. The same major helped me do that. He got the Pentagon to waive the right and let me transfer out of the Army ROTC into the military, Air Force ROTC. And this woman, the draft board, was still trying to draft me all the way through. I got my commission in the military. She still wanted to draft me. And it wasn't until a couple of years after that, when I had orders to go on active duty, that she finally stopped sending me notices. So it was all a mixture of the military and academia and bureaucracy. But that, in a sense, I guess I served in the Army through the National Guard, in the military through Navy pre-flight and some flight training after that, and then in the Air Force as an officer, and I got assigned to the Air Force Academy as a faculty member.
Oh.
That happened because I got started while I was working on my PhD. I got started working on questions of law. I went in to ask Professor Gray, a man who was Professor Adams' co-author, Horace Gray. I asked him, what should I do? And he said, you should go ahead and get a law degree. He said, there are very few economists who know any law and no lawyers who know any economics. And with that, I began taking part-time law school courses, and it eventually ended up, took some while I was in the military, and got out and finished law school, and then went to Harvard for a year of study as a graduate law student. But that got me through.
Boy, I should say. When you did return to the academic world completely, early on you became involved in academic administration and were president of other institutions before being named president of Michigan State University. Tell us about those presidencies, the years, and how they differed or didn't differ from the presidency of Michigan State.
When I finished work at Harvard Law School, the faculty at the law school at Alabama asked me if I would come back and be there. So I went back and was on the law faculty for a little over 2.5 years. I got a chance then to go to Washington to work for Estes Kefauver, and I was one of the assistant counsels to the Senate Antitrust Subcommittee. I stayed in Washington a bit longer. Najib Halaby was head of FAA. I had an encounter with him, and he ended up offering me a job. I talked to Senator Kefauver and to his administrative assistant about the offer, and they said it looked like a good job. He wanted me to create a run a new office of policy development. So I went to FAA and did that. Then Halaby was leaving the FAA to go be president of Pan American Airways, and he and Alan Boyd, who was in the chairman of Civil Aeronautics Board, got together. They knew that the president was going to move Mr. Boyd from being head of Civil Aeronautics Board to be the Undersecretary of Commerce for Transportation. And Halaby told Boyd, said, if you're going to do that, you need to take Mackey with you. And they had done all of that, made all the arrangements, and they called me in and said, we've made arrangements for you to move to the Department of Commerce. And so I went over. There were very few people in the office, and it had never done very much. And the president said he wanted Mr. Boyd to do things. And after a fairly short time, Mr. Boyd came back from the White House one day, and it was not uncommon for me to meet with him and talk about what he had done. And he said, the president wants a transportation policy recommendation, and he's appointed me chairman of a committee, and he had four other people. And he said, you are now the executive secretary of that committee. Go draft the final report, and when you've got the final report drafted, I'll call the first meeting of the committee. And that's what he meant, and that's what happened. There was one man who worked in that office who was knowledgeable enough to be of help, a man named Byron Knupp. And he and I found help from a few other people, but I put together a proposal, took it to Mr. Boyd. He took it to the White House, and the president decided to accept that, and it became the Department of Transportation. Mr. Boyd ultimately became the first secretary, and I was appointed assistant secretary for policy development. It was that background which meant that when when the presidency changed, Nixon was elected, and he withdrew the appointments of all of the Johnson appointees everywhere. And Republicans or Democrats, if they were Johnson appointees, he withdrew them. And at that point, Mr. Boyd knew the man who was president of the University of Florida. He called him. They had a possibility of looking for an executive vice president. I went down and talked to the people at Florida, and they didn't fill the job. It was a year or two later that they finally filled it. But the chancellor of the Florida system was in Steve O'Connell's office, the president of the University of Florida, Steve O'Connell, when the call from Mr. Boyd came in. So the chancellor of the system heard the discussion of me, and then he found out that Florida was not going to do anything, so he recommended me to the man who was the new president at Florida State. And he and I met. He had been the dean of education there and had just been appointed maybe 2 months before, something like that. I went to Tallahassee. We met, got along well. He offered me the job, and I had left the government, and so I took the job. I was administrative vice president for 3 months while they created the job of executive vice president. Then I served there and had been there for about a year and a half, maybe a little more than that. And the presidency of the University of South Florida was vacant. And there was some give and take among people who were trying out. I didn't do anything about it except at some point the chairman of the board said, I think you should go around and speak privately with each of the board members. So I did that, and as a result of that, I was offered the presidency at University of South Florida. And from there, after about 6 years, I had been involved in candidacy for the presidency of the University of Texas at Austin. And it got down to a point where there were two people left. I was one, and the other person was the dean of the graduate school at UT Austin. The search committee had found her unqualified and recommended me, I think unanimously, for the presidency. And it was almost settled one weekend, and somebody connected with the board decided that she would be a better president because she would be much more responsive to him and to other members of the board. And so we were all set, contract agreed to, it worked out all the details. And I got a call from the chancellor saying the board has changed its mind and they were electing, they took this other person. And it turned out I wouldn't have voted for president, but I liked her and worked with her while she was president at UT Austin and I was president at Texas Tech, because the people at UT Austin recommended me to be president of Texas Tech. And so I went there, and I asked the man who was chancellor at Texas system, and he said, it's a good place to go. It's sort of like in baseball, you go to Atlanta and you try out, you're there 2 or 3 years, and then something else happens. I was there 3 years, and I got a call from somebody at Michigan State.
Did you find Michigan State's presidency different, a different type of presidency than the previous two?
Oh, yes.
In what ways?
Well, one thing, it was a land-grant institution. Neither of the other two was, though Texas Tech was almost a land-grant institution for West Texas because it was so far away from everything, but much more research-oriented, and it was constitutional in its recognition. And at the University of South Florida, every morning I'd get a stack of papers from the head office. There wasn't a stack like that at Michigan State.
Oh.
But you were a constitutional entity at Michigan State, so you had your board, and that was it. You had to deal with the legislature and budget, but by and large, it was very different. And the concept of who would be hired as faculty and what you would do was all quite different from either South Florida, I was the second president there, or Texas Tech, where I was the 9th president. I came here, I was the 16th president. And Lash LaRue and I joked about who was the 9th president and who was the 16th president of the United States, and Abe Lincoln was the 16th president of the United States. So that, we had a good run on that for a long time with LaRue.
Do you remember any specific incidents, big or small, that occurred during the presidency here that you think of?
How long have you got for the list?
Well, let's just choose some.
Oh, well, there were all kinds of things. I had what I considered basically a good relationship with the board. But the board, when I got here, was not as familiar with some of what it was doing as it should have been. And certainly the first major issue that came up, it lasted for a substantial amount of time, was what to do about the Alumni Association. The board, when I got here, had almost given away all of its authority over the alumni relationships. And there were people in the community who didn't believe that having the board elected was a good idea. They didn't want to run for anything, but they wanted to serve as a board. And there were several things that they had in the works, and they were down to having a final vote on what would have essentially conveyed all of the responsibilities for much of Michigan State's activities to separate entities that were not under the board. And so I read the documents and saw what was happening. I had to then go to the board chairman and individual members and tell them what they were about to do and that they were going to really do damage to the institution. The people who were tied in with that were ones who were very interested in athletics, and they wanted to get the fundraising transferred from the university to a foundation. So I had to explain to the board members what that would mean, what that would do to the university. And that led to a long-running fight, and the board eventually had to just tell the alumni group that you can't do that. You're not going to have that authority. And that was a major activity, and there were a number of other major universities who had similar types of problems. And there were several of them who came to Michigan State to see what we had done. And most of them had not gotten as deeply involved as Michigan State. But it was a long, bitter fight.
I bet. Now, because today when I looked at the alumni board, it seems to be quite powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's appointed by the board. The president is involved. What they were suggesting was that the whole function be taken away from the board and be under a private entity that didn't report to the board but reported to a group of people who were supporters of the athletic program.
That would have been...
So that, you know, that's an example.
That's a major difference.
That was a big one, yeah.
Right. Oh, I should say. And a long-lasting fight.
Well, it took two or three years. We were pretty much through with it by the time I left the presidency. But it took a long time after that for the new fashion and the people who were brought in to establish the way things should run. But we had some very good people who worked very hard, and it became a very active alumni association, which is totally trustworthy as far as the university is concerned, and that was what they wanted to separate.
Were there any other issues that you had this kind of struggle with?
Not quite like that. There were a few, the Breslin Center. The university had wanted to have a center like the Breslin Center for 20 or 25 years. There had been proposals, people had looked at it. And it was very close to the time when I had told the board I was going to leave the presidency. So I called my staff together one time and was talking about it, and I said, this is not a good way to leave this. We need such a facility, and I don't want somebody to look around in 5 or 10 or 15 years and say, we could have had one, and now things have happened that we can't. I'd like you to put together a proposal that will show the best way to fund it, and I will take that to the board. And that was an issue that some of the people were enthused about and some weren't, because we had to find a way to generate the funds, and there wasn't a ready source. And we had some people who had done some creative thinking about that with the Wharton Center. So we got together and we came up with a proposal to build the Breslin Center. It didn't have the name at the time, but we decided how big it should be and all the details about it. And then I went to the board and said, here's a proposal. You can vote on this and you can have the center. The costs are at a reasonable level. And if you don't do this, it looks like the costs are going to be rising. And 5 years or 10 years from now, nobody will say the president didn't do anything, because here it is. But the board has got to do it. And it took them a good while to think about it. One of the things we had to do was find a time for the board to discuss it. We have an open meetings law. So we just scheduled a meeting at, I think it was 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at Cole's house, and made the announcement of a meeting. We were going to have dinner and have a conversation. And we had discussed what we would do if a reporter strolled in. Nobody appeared. So the board was there. We had our dinner. We had a conversation. Met all the legal requirements. It had the notice. You know, it was truly public. And they decided they wanted to think about it, and they said, all right, 48 hours, something like that, we'll decide. And they decided to go ahead and do it, and hence the Breslin Center is there.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yes, it's been a great addition to the campus. Oh, no doubt about it. Now, what year did you leave the presidency and take on the role of professor of economics?
1985.
Walter would have said you stepped up to the professorship.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't argue with that.
Good. Now tell us about your present professional life, your teaching and other outside activities.
My teaching has evolved into a program where I teach two film courses in the summer and two economics courses in the fall. And the economics courses have become hybrid courses, and I don't meet them in a regular lecture series like I used to. And I had started doing things like that early on campus and had websites and a different approach to the way we went through the course long before most of the rest of the faculty had done that. And at one point for 2 to 3 years, a number of the colleges or departments or other units would ask me to come over. I would take my teaching assistant and we would run the program and show them how it worked and explain to them what it meant, how the students reacted. And I've continued to do that, and I've been very fortunate to have just some terrific teaching assistants, and have remained very obviously uninformed as to how to do many of the things I could get my teaching assistants to do. But that's become the nature of my teaching, and I've enjoyed using those courses to develop ideas that are important to me in those areas. And the students seem to survive it fairly well. So.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then the economics courses, I teach comparative economic systems, and that has changed as a course because 10 to 15 years ago, people started saying, well, everybody's going to a system much like the United States and England and some of the other countries have. So it's not going to work. You know, you don't need to worry about it. Everybody's going to do this. Well, it didn't work out that way. And even the more communistic countries, by their own declaration, have come around, and we have several, four, I guess, that you'd say were strongly avowed communists, but they don't function that way. Cuba, Vietnam, Venezuela, there are a few.
China.
Yeah, China. But they are less communistic. They're more fascistic than they are communistic. But with those four, there are a few others, and they hang on quite a bit. But I've been able to develop the course and explore some of the philosophy of it. The other course which I teach is basically a product of my other kind of activity. The title of it is Economics, Oil, and Islam.
Fascinating. That's fascinating.
I developed it as a course. Excuse me. Because I had spent nearly 25 years as a special advisor to the Sheikh, who was the minister of higher education and scientific technology. And with one other person, the two of us were the principal advisors on the whole economic system and the teaching of it and education.
Bless you.
For the United Arab Emirates. And I'd had a call in the 1987, I guess, just a year after I'd left the presidency. And I got invited to do something with them in a review session. And the Sheikh apparently liked what I did. When it was all over, they adopted the reservation, the recommendations we made. And I told him, I said, I've enjoyed this. If you ever have anything else going on, I'd be happy to come back. And about 6 months after that, he said, we'd like you to come and help us implement the recommendations. I said, which ones? He said, all of them. And that led to a relationship that lasted until 2 years ago now, when he left that role and moved over as a cabinet officer in the UAE to be the Minister of Culture. And I'm still there. He asked me to continue and do the same kinds of things I had done before, though it's very different with him being a Minister of Culture. I don't know that much about culture. But I've treated that course as one where I tell my students, this is about economics, it's about oil, and it's about Islam. I don't know a significant amount of any of the three, so if I put them all together, I don't know a lot about them collectively, but we'll make a course out of it.
But it's I'm sure there is a strong connection between each of
these.
Oh,
yeah, there is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we begin with about 1848, 1849. Look at the creation of the corporation, how Rockefeller got involved, how that all developed. And so the economics and oil came along collectively together. And the nature of the Industrial Revolution changed, and oil became important, first just for light to replace kerosene, then as a driver of ships and of trains. then later as an instrument of war, and then later on in the 20th century, oil became important as a result of Islamic countries and their control. So we really take a period that runs from about 1850 or 1845 and take it up into the time of about 1987, 1989, mm-hmm. around in there. And then we talk a little bit about the rest, but we do the history of oil and its relationship to the countries, Germany's interest in the Middle East and England's interest, and what happened after the First World War when we carved up the Middle East, made countries where we didn't have them before.
Mainly in terms of oil.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating. It's fascinating.
Well, and these are hybrid courses, and I give the students a fair warning before I let them sign up. They're going to have to be familiar with the Internet. They're going to have to do their own research. They're going to have to choose within broad areas what they want to be interested in, and they're going to have to write anywhere from 5 to 7 or 8 papers during the course, and we probably won't have a final exam.
Sounds like a fascinating course. If I were younger and smarter, I think I would take it.
Right.
Yeah, because it's really historically fascinating. And, of course, today we're embroiled in that whole culture of oil, yeah. economics, and Islam.
We are. And if you take a look at oil in the modern context, you have to look at sunlight, wind, all the alternatives, and fracking. Some European countries have disallowed fracking. We've allowed it, and we've said we don't ever have to be responsible to meet our needs with foreigners. And that's going to be an issue, I'm sure, in the coming presidential election.
Oh, I know.
But we don't get into that much, but for one thing, the no textbooks, all you can do is talk about it and bring in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal to keep up with it for you. But we do talk about it, and they have to form some opinions for themselves. And we have a fair number of conservatives and a fair number of liberals. And
it must be fascinating to teach. And it's stimulating for you, I am sure.
I do enjoy it. Over the 25 years of my association with the United Arab Emirates, I've probably been there, I'd say much nearer 100 times than 50 times, but it's somewhere in that number.
Such a full life that you're living and have lived. How would you compare and or contrast teaching to administration?
I find it easier to think of getting a full load of administrative experience than I find it easy to feel you'll get a full load of teaching. That may be different from what some others do who've not had much of the administrative activities. I was, in a sense, fortunate, I guess, to have a number of the administrative opportunities when I was quite young.
Very young.
I was just turning 40 when I became president at South Florida. When I left Michigan State's presidency, I had been an executive vice president for a couple of years almost, and then about 14 years as president. And that, you know, that's a lot of being a president, especially when you have major financial obligations to meet, changes in the university, changes that affect almost everything you do. So if I had gotten to be president 10 or 15 years later at 55, instead of 40.
Exactly.
It would be very different. But teaching has been fascinating for me. I've been able to shape courses that I liked here, and the faculty members and the administrators who make those decisions have been very cooperative and very supportive. And I think the nature of the student reactions have been good. I don't know whether I've gotten any favorite treatment or not, but it is, has worked well. It's worked well.
Absolutely. We would be interested in hearing what you see as the role of higher education in American society today.
Oh, goodness. I don't think it's as different as many people say it is. And I guess my experience as an economist leads me to some of that. You know, if you go back and look at economic development, you see that in the middle of the 19th century, we had the Industrial Revolution. The industry changed, agriculture changed, where people lived changed. How many people were engaged in agriculture changed. All those things changed dramatically. And people said, well, doesn't this change everything? We're going to have to change a lot. And we didn't. If we were good on our values and we taught values and skills that were preparing people not for their first job but for a lifetime, you teach a lot of things that are not what people are saying, in my judgment, we should be teaching now. And there used to be much more discussion publicly of what a liberal education did for people. And the general conclusion was that it was probably better than most things. Liberal education prepared you for a career that would lead to major responsibilities. And I'm not sure that that's what education is being called on to do. I think the real purpose of higher education should be to give people a broad sense of what it means to be a human being, what it means to live in the society we live in, what it means to try to change the society, and where have we failed, and how do we look at those failures as part of our responsibility. I look at those things when I teach comparative economic systems, and I look at our society, and there are certainly large segments of our society where the preparation for careers and for lifetimes is sadly lacking. And I think that higher education in particular should deal with those things. And if we let the high school guidance counselors, some of our parents, and some of the people in the corporate world influence what we teach, what we offer, what we do, directed away from those values so that they're not taking care of the human needs, then we will have failed. And I see that as a...
Do you see we're moving in that direction away from the preparation for lifesmanship rather than for just a career?
Yes.
And we seem to be moving.
Yes.
Okay, I was going to ask you, but you touched on a more fundamental issue, I think, with this idea of higher education being the goal to make us proper human beings rather than necessarily prepared for a specific profession or career. And but I was also going to ask you about how you feel about talk in this public arena. There's much talk about higher education, much of it negative, but not so much on the issue that you raise, which I happen to think is a significant issue, but on topics such as the spiraling costs of college or the employment of adjunct or gypsy faculty in undergraduate courses, or the increasing use of online courses, with some colleges offering the entire undergraduate program online. What is your take on some of these other issues?
I think we have a very serious problem with people who are taking higher education, creating icons which are anti-humane, and they're using that as a means for justifying shifting the financial burden to people, many of whom can't afford it, and a great many of them being driven away from higher education. And many of those who aren't driven away coming away from their higher education with monumental debt that is just unconscionable. And for any public institution that sponsors universities or community colleges or the public schools and does away with the support of those, that's just a terrible thing to do. And I think it's very sad to have that happening. And I think that we're going to end up selling short our human capacity as a nation because we aren't following up on what we should be doing. And for states to cut the support of higher education as they have done, the share of the cost of a per student educational program has dropped dramatically from what the state used to provide and what it provides now. And that's because it became popular to say, I hate taxes. And the people who say that don't understand what it takes to live in the modern world. And what they're doing is making it possible for people who are anti-tax for whatever reason, frequently for political objectives rather than anything else, to shape the world we live in, and they're going to eliminate much of what it's taken us 150 years to build into our system. And I think it's just tragic.
Would you like to see any concrete changes at Michigan State that might enable it to better fulfill the role you envision for the university?
I'm going to plead what I've pled before when people ask me those questions. I had 6 years. I had to deal with a lot of questions. I made a lot of proposals. Some of them were enacted. But when I left the presidency, I decided and said, I'm not going to comment on issues like that.
Fair enough. Thank you for sharing with us your experiences, your insights, and thank you for your continuing service to Michigan State and to its students.
Thank you very much. I enjoy being a part of it. I'm dedicated to the green and white of Michigan State.
Hooray.